Here we go.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, everybody. Yeah, I'm back again. Haha, isn't this great? And the sun is really trying to come out in Upper Westchester today, considering yesterday it was a gloomy kind of day. It looked like it was going to snow, not even rain. That's how cold it was.
Oh my God.
But
it was cold.
Yeah, it was cold. And it's cold outside today, which is great because too hot is really no good. And this is going to be a lot of fun because we're going to heat you up with this book. Ha! It's a good way to get into it. When Rhys Johnson was a boy, a fire destroyed his home, killing his mother and brothers while leaving him scarred for life. This guy loves fire. He loves to burn things. It also kindled something dark inside of him, an irresistible attraction to flames that is terrifying as tantalizing power. But after two failed arson attempts and two trips to the mental ward, he finally was able to put the matches down and pick up the pieces. So we have New York Times bestselling author here, Vincent Zandri, and he's going to tell us about Everything Burns. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Fran. Thanks for having me again, having me on your show again.
Oh, fun. I'm glad, and
you'll
I can't
have to forgive
wait.
Me if I'm like, you'll have to forgive me if I sound like a zombie. I'm jet lagged. I've got the seasonal allergies, you know, the whole bit.
Oh yeah, I can identify with the allergies and whatever. My eyes are like bugging out, and I'm getting email. Yeah, my eyes are bugging out. Forget it. I don't know. Oh, who is that? Oh, that's good. I got an answer to my question finally from somebody. Now we're buying our co-op, and it's getting to be convoluted with the banks and the lady from the whatever just answered me, so I'll have to deal with some other person later. They can wait. But, yeah.
Oh, no.
The last couple of days, yeah, my eyes have been bugging out, not so much inside but outside. And when it takes me more than, you know, 2 hours to read 500 pages, I know my eyes are bugging out. That's no good. So
yeah, try writing like that. I mean, I guess they said that this year is like one of the worst ever because it was such a long winter and such a cold winter that everything waited to bloom at once. And
yeah,
so, you know, anybody affected by pollen has gotten slammed.
Yeah, it is. It's like between that and other things that forget it, that affect my face, like, oh, my God. Yesterday I just wanted to walk out with a mask. That would have been so much better. You know, maybe I would have scared a few people, but I don't really care.
That's okay,
point, no.
where I was, all the women were wearing masks.
Yeah, wait till I scare you at the Thriller Fest.
Okay,
when
great.
I'm going to be there, actually. I'm excited.
All right, I'll be there.
I know, I heard, and you're up for an award, right?
Yeah, I'm up for Best Paperback Original for 2015. So I'm it's one of those things where you're like, I'm happy to be nominated, you know, because I'll, you know, that it's a nice honor, but I want to win, of course. Yeah.
Well,
I'm not gonna lie. How do you
vote for somebody in that category? I know you're up against three people that I don't know, and then you're up against, I think Joseph Finder is in that category too. Is he
it
up
could
for the
be.
Fixer? Yeah, I think he's up for
it
the
could
fixer.
Be. You know, to be honest, like I got the notification and like, you know, I like put it away and I haven't looked at it since. You know, I would, oh my God.
But just to be nominated. I mean, I'm excited because I'm going to be in the same room with all of you guys and Nelson DeMille. And I just finished. They sent me his book out of nowhere. I didn't ask for it. I was like, I just finished Radiant Angel. And wait till they read my review. I hope they like it.
All right, good.
Yeah, and I just finished Daniel Palmer's book also.
All right. Wow.
Oh, this one doesn't
count. I'm way behind on my reading.
Yeah, you wait till you read Constant Fear. You're going to be constantly afraid. Oh, my God, that's scary.
All right, yeah.
So
like
why did you decide to concentrate on arson in this particular novel?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. I know that at the time I was, you know, I wanted to write this story, and I wrote, like, the basic story of Everything Burns. And at the time, I was just calling it The Breakup. You know, I didn't really have a title for it. And it was a big book, a different book, a book that doesn't follow, you know, it doesn't really follow a lot of the rules of typical suspense novel. You know, there's a big literary component to it. But I also at the time was watching a lot of Hitchcock. And I think I was watching Vertigo, and I was, you know, and just when I, you know, when Jimmy, you know, Jimmy Stewart's got this story going, and like when he, you know, like he climbs a ladder and he gets this vertigo or whatever. So I'm like, oh, you know, it'd be really cool to give my character something, you know, this psychological situation that he just can't avoid at all, and he reacts to everything that happens in his life according to that psychological situation. And, you know, and in dealing with his character and with his history, I thought the most natural psychological malady, if you want to call it that, was going to be he was going to be a pyromaniac. So that's how it really came about. And then, you know, and that helps really further develop the story, if not, you know, sort of control it.
It is really good. I mean, every time you think he's going to get cured, he doesn't. Just burning the stuff at the waste paper basket. You know, sometimes people just like to look at fire because it just mesmerizes them for some reason.
Yeah, I did a lot of research on it, and it was it's really an amazing thing. You know, like people are fascinated with it, and it happens in childhood. You know, like something about fire.
Yeah.
I think, to be honest, you know, from my research, it you know, and, you know, I'm no expert, but it's like a control issue. It's about control. And in this book, and everything burns, obviously, with every page that passes, he's losing control of his situation. And so the only thing he can control is the fire.
Well, he can control when he does it, how powerful it's going to be, and
right.
Who he gets rid of. Well, I started the book. I read this. It's right in front of me. I had to hide it from a few people that wanted to take it away. there aren't too many people. You know, it's really hard because I'm a reader, as everybody knows, because my mother used to make me read 10 books a week, for real, and take notes on them.
God.
That's probably why my reviews are the way they are. Oh, well, too bad, people. That's just the way it is. And my brother-in-law, it reads. My husband reads, and maybe one or two other people. And I have to literally not, you know, I have to hide the book or tell them after I'm done with the interview, I just did this one or that one. And I go, well, when is it mine? And there's a long list waiting for that. There's a long list waiting for this one. Yeah. When is it mine?
All right.
You know, you're not getting it.
Well, we can always send more your way.
Oh, yeah? Because there's a whole bunch of people, let me tell you, that want to read it. And my question is, I'm doing a show with like 5 people on September 8th, and one of the questions I'm going to ask is, how come in this particular book, which I found very helpful, you started with a prologue of what happened before to help readers understand Reese better? Some people start with a flashback. Some people start with a prologue, like this one, that's a flashback. Some people start with historical fiction in all sorts of different ways. So my thing lately is, how come you started it with a prologue, which made it easier for me? And also, this was one of those books that I didn't have to sit with a graphic organizer to figure out who was in it.
That's because they're right in the first person.
I was a reading and writing specialist, and there's a book I'm reading right now, and it's got at least 100 characters and 75 situations. Yeah, and I know I can follow the plot. I'm just saying no one in their right mind is going to want to read this.
It's
too long.
Yeah, I'm no Einstein, so I have to keep it simple. But, you know, certainly the way I started Everything Burns was to ground the character. You know, just to give that character a focal point and you know, and a reason why he is who he is as the opening scene takes place on chapter one. But it's to ground the character and to entice the reader. And you're going to know, like, if you read that and you're like, no, this isn't for me, you know, you're already out the door, or you're invested immediately after 3 pages. So it's weird because when I write my books, I usually just start from the first, you know, the first moment of the novel action, you know, or whatever, or the first conflict or whatever's happening. And then only when I'm into it a little bit do I start thinking about a prologue. You know, like, does this book require, you know, does the book, first of all, require a prologue? And if it does, do I want to to be a flashback, or do I want it to be a situation that takes place further down the road in the book?
Mm-hmm.
And then say like, okay, you know, like do like, you know, the prologue, and then say like 3 days earlier or something like that, which I happen to love in movies and books. I love that. But it doesn't always work. But so it's really, it's something that, you know, prologues are really something that happens, for me anyway, like organically. I have to be into the story a little bit before I decide, you know, whether it needs one and what it's going to be.
Well, this is where the prologue starts, and I could smell the smoke. It says, the boy wakes to smoke and fire. The thick black smoke chokes his 10-year-old lungs. You could feel the heat. You could feel what's happening. The description is so real that anybody that doesn't just keep turning pages is crazy. Because the book itself, the prologue is on fire itself.
Yeah, and hopefully, hopefully that comes across, you know. And I was a little bit freaked out with the situation that what happened in Washington just recently with the that family being killed and then the fire, that house being, you know, burned.
It's scary.
You know?
It's scary.
Yeah.
It is scary. I'm reading so many books about terrorist attacks and how, I wonder sometimes how these authors figure out that these Islamic and Muslim people, guys, and or wherever they choose their people to come from, how they actually know what's in their mind. Is if they don't say they actually interview them, because I doubt that they do, but then you never know.
Yeah.
And I often wonder, how do they write this stuff, making it sound as to why America is so awful, and why an author, an American author, would want to portray us so evilly and make people want to kill us in a book. And it's scary because I've read so many of them, and after a while I get angry. And then when I read it on Facebook, when anybody says something about America or how they feel, you're entitled to your opinion, but still, Facebook is all over the world and they see it.
Sure. You know, and I just got back from North Africa a couple of days ago, and you know, and I asked a lot of questions, you know, how do you feel about ISIS, who are, you know, right at the doorstep and all this, and the, you know.
ISIS is scary.
And the very, very, very peaceful Muslims that I speak with are like, you know what, we're not going to put up with it. We're just not going to put up with it. If they come anywhere near here, you know, we're going to eradicate them, and that's it.
Let's hope so. Let's hope so.
You know. Let's definitely hope so, because what's happening in the world right now reminds me is way too reminiscent of the 1930s. It just is way too reminiscent of that.
Yeah, I know. The people that took a blind eye to Hitler, that's even scarier. I know, because my grandmother was in a concentration camp, but I know what happened to her. And it's scary. And
where
it's
was
funny
she?
Because she was in Poland.
Oh, she was in, so probably
Dachau.
Bergen-Belsen or maybe Dachau.
Yeah, Dachau, I think.
Wow.
And she told me, I don't know why, she told me, she didn't tell anybody else. It was like really weird. She told me what she went through. And I cried. I could not believe it.
So she survived.
She survived because she was strong-willed and brave. And then she wound up getting into escaping to the underground somehow, she and her sisters.
Right.
And my grandfather, she was my step-grandmother, but I didn't know that. But she was my best friend in the whole world, my grandmother. And my grandfather was married to somebody, to Fanny, who I never met. And when he brought her to America, he went back to get my grandmother and her sisters out from the underground, Polish underground.
Wow.
Yeah, so he brought her here. And my grandfather, I just wrote a big story for him for a blog that I write for. It's coming out on June 10th. My grandfather sold apples on a street corner to make money, and then he wound up, he made a lot of money selling apple. Yeah, so he went into this whole thing. So it's scary. So anyway.
It's very scary. It's
good,
you know,
it could happen now, and people are naive. They don't see it. They don't see it.
People don't want to believe it, but, you know, some of the places I've been the past couple of years, you know, even to admit you're, you know, you're Christian or you're Jewish or, you know, don't, you know, or even admitting you're American. So,
I know.
And, you know, what's happening now is a process of appeasement. You hate to see it, but, you know, I think what's going to happen is, you know, certainly if Iran gets the nuke, we're up for a global conflict that I don't think that anybody's going to be able to avoid.
That's what's scary. That's what's really
It's like
scary.
A long-planned murder.
Well, if anybody wants to read something that it could really scare you, William Fornething, I think I remember his last name, Day of Wrath. It's about what happens when ISIS takes over all the schools in the United States and what happens because no one stops them and they take a blind
right.
eye. This book was like 147 pages. I shook as I read it, but it was good. So what changes Reese and allows him to realize that maybe he needs to change and Fire and Flames was the wrong way to go? And he's an author, right? So what does he write?
He's an author. He writes like thrillers and whatever and it, his situation was, you know, I based some of the book on my real life situation with my wife. Mm-hmm. You know, Laura and I divorced, I don't know, what, about 8 years ago or something like that. And at the time we split up, I just was going through this period. I couldn't write anything. I couldn't, you know, it was just like, I don't know what was going on. And, you know, the whole thing was just a mess. And
mm-hmm.
we sort of amicably split. But ironically, at that time, like as we split, I started writing again. And, you know, my career really kept, you know, started improving again and almost like leaps and bounds and whatever. And so I like used that for the basis of the book a little bit, and then Laura and I have gotten back together in real life. We're not married again, but we did get back together.
That's
and
good.
So, like, you know, and then like Reese gets back together with his ex,
mm-hmm.
only the difference is Reese gets back with her again and suddenly he can't write again. So he, you know, he goes right back to the fire, he goes right back to his drinking, he goes right back to all this bad stuff. And then he finds out that she's actually speaking with and communicating with the boyfriend she had while they were broken up.
Mm-hmm.
And that this boyfriend, in fact, is a writer. And that, in fact, Reese, you know, and that, in fact, I don't want to spoil it
yeah,
too
don't
much.
Tell
but,
people, yeah.
but, you know, that's as far as I'll go with it. Anyway, it becomes this almost like competition between the two, but a very violent and physical competition.
Well, that I sort of felt, and I sort of got annoyed with her because she even dealt with him, because as my mother used to say, when the situation's over, it's over. That's it. Move on.
That's right.
And yeah, she used to. I you know, all sorts of crazy sayings that Ruthie used to come up with.
I wanted to experiment a little bit with this book and like the opening scene with. The daughter and the grandmother and you know, that actually happened. You know, Laura was actually going out to have some sort of eye surgery or whatever, and
mm-hmm.
and she, you know, her mother was driving or whatever. And I mean, that's as far as the reality goes. That was about it. That's
mm-hmm.
about it. And then I took off from there. But you know, and I was thinking, what if like this guy finally gets back with her, and like
mm-hmm.
she really is communicating with this guy. And, you know, and the paranoia will ensue. And the guy's already been in the nut house twice, you know, and
mm-hmm.
so his paranoia takes over.
Well, that's what makes it great, because sometimes you take a real-life situation and you turn it into something really dangerous and evil, and it makes it more interesting because it's more real to you to write about also.
Yeah. I know, and the problem I've had with this book, if you even want to call it that, is some people – you know, or like, oh my God, that's me, or whatever. And I'm like, no, it's not. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, like, certainly.
I identify with this.
Right. I mean, certainly, you know, characters are inspired by certain players who have existed. But by all means in this book, you know, no one, you know, it's all made up, you know. But you know, we all borrow a little bit from real life, you know. And I think some of the best stories are ones that are inspired by real life. You know, and then other stories of mine are just complete fabrications. Yeah.
Well, I'm writing my first murder, and my face
is
behind this. Yeah, well, I wrote Faces Behind the Stone 1, 2, and 3. I'm trying to get it out there more.
Right.
And everybody that read
right.
it thought it was really... It's told from the point of view of the dead person behind the stone
uh-huh.
that is murdered because they deserve to be. And
oh,
then the
awesome.
Next one, yeah, well, I'm killing off a few people in real, you know, fake but real life, but...
right.
I'm writing a story based on real life events, but I changed it to the point that no one's going to know that I wrote it about this person.
Right.
And it's what I think happened to someone close to me, what I
right.
know happened. So I'm killing
okay.
off the person. But the cool part is that my hairdresser wants to be the bad guy, and my mother's manicurist wants to be the person that's close to me. And,
oh, that's funny.
Yeah, it is funny. It's hilarious. And my hairdresser right. is Lou. His real name is not Tony. Tony's going to be the name of the bad guy. Is Louis
okay.
Sayer. So instead of working for whoever the person worked for, she's going to be a managing partner of a law firm, the Louis Fader Law
okay.
Firm. And she's
awesome.
Going to, you know, keel over and die and have a heart attack like this person really did, but not exactly where the person did.
Okay.
But
okay.
I was told
oh, yeah,
that if
like
you write
it.
Something like that, that if you write it and even though the events are may believe and the person that sort of forgot to do something didn't do it, I have to be careful. Because what happens
right.
is that she keeled over. Somebody was there with her, but they never called 911 on time.
Oh, okay.
They waited. So, yeah, that's the hard part. I'm gonna write it that way, but... We'll be careful.
Right.
But anyway.
Well, you know,
I'm gonna have,
you got to write it the way
have,
you want
I'm
to write
have,
it.
I'm going to have somebody read it before I send it. Once it's edited, I'm going to ask a few people to read it to make sure that I have it,
yeah.
that I have it right. And I'm very excited because my nephew and I wrote one together. And it's a baseball
oh, very
story.
Nice.
That's, yeah, he's got a broken hip. He got hurt in baseball. And he figured we're going to write the competitor, it's called, and it's about these
okay.
two, this kid that's a catcher, and somebody comes up from the mine and wants to take his place, and he's going to get rid of him. That's all I'm going to
uh-huh.
say. And it's a good storyline. It's probably better than his aunt could come up with. I don't know.
Yeah,
anyway,
a lot of baseball fans out there.
Yeah, I know. So that's why I said to him, Jake, if you write this with me, maybe, you know, I'll give him half the royalties, split it with him. I said, and then maybe
right.
you won't have to worry about going to college. No, he's very smart. So
that's
who's
great.
Coming after him? And we talked about David. So every time he gets upset, he strikes out and he decides to use fire. So he falls back. So does he take medication or...
He's
does
supposed
he just,
to, yeah.
But he doesn't, right?
Right. He, you know, like many people in this situation, he starts feeling good about
mm-hmm.
himself and feels extremely functional and decides, well, maybe I don't need the medication anymore. And that's one of, you know, that's a human frailty, I guess. But and she reminds him, his wife, you know, Lisa reminds him, you know, you need to be back on your medication. You need to be seeing your psychiatrist and all this sort of stuff because she sees the paranoia consuming him.
Well, she sees his paranoia, but she doesn't see something else that's right in front of her either.
Yeah,
his,
you know, and
what is,
I...
Yeah,
I,
that's
it's
what's
funny
scary.
Because
she sees what she wants to see, but she doesn't
yeah,
see what is really
yeah,
there.
Yeah, she does. She's not without fault in this.
Yeah.
There's no doubt.
Yeah. So what is his relationship with his daughter, with Anna, and with her mother?
Like, he's been, like, kind of the absentee father, you know?
Mm.
I mean, he's had a relationship with her, but it's been very hands-off during the period that they were split up for whatever reason, be it, you know, distance or just be it that he was, you know, emotionally couldn't deal with it or whatever. But now that... they're back together, she, you know, Anna doesn't see him quite as her father yet, so much as just this guy that's sort of come back into their life only a lot more permanently, and that's why she doesn't call him Dad, she calls him by his first name, Reese, you know, like, and then she plays with it and calls him Reese Pieces and stuff
pieces.
Like that, you know, and I think he wants to immediately jump into her, you know, him being like dad sudden, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
it doesn't exactly happen that way with kids, you know.
The other character in the book that I love being called is the dog.
Oh,
is
yeah,
Frankie.
Right, Lou.
Yeah.
Frankie, right.
Frankie. You know, it's funny because that's my nickname for some stupid reason. I don't know why. Guy in the deli calls me Frankie, and when I was younger, they used to call me that because my father actually wanted
that's funny.
He got stuck with me, yes, I told him. But after a while,
right.
He realized I was the brains of the family, so, you know, just keep the girl. What can I tell you?
Right.
Well,
you know, it's funny
because
I have – it's based – you know, Frankie's based on the – you know, the dog who's asleep on the bed right now. But, you know, like, maybe it's a writer's thing, but, you know, I'm alone all day, and sometimes I talk to the dog, you know.
Yeah, well,
and,
at least they'll give you an answer you might want to hear or a bark you might want to hear.
Yeah, you know, and obviously it's a tool, you know. I've used it a couple of times in books now. I think I've used it like 3 times, and I got to like stop for the next one anyway. But, you know, he like, you know, it's obviously a good tool to use, you know, to like relay, you know, pertinent information and to
mm-hmm.
also add a little levity to the book, you know what I mean? Because otherwise it'd be like,
yeah.
Oh, my God, this thing's so heavy, you know.
But I like this character. I like this book. I like this style. So who is Rachel?
Okay, Rachel is the artist whom he had had a serious relationship with while he and Lisa were broken up.
Mm-hmm.
And she really fell for him. And he, as you know, and when their situation broke up and he went back to his ex-wife, she felt as though that the whole thing was plotted out and planned out to begin with.
She's
extremely angry about it. That's all I'm going to say.
That's all we'll say. Yeah, she's a little paranoid over there, too. You know, people, if it doesn't work out, oh, well, moving right along.
Like, yeah, he knows how to pick them.
He picks a whole bunch of dead grapes here. So who is Detective Miller? I like that guy. He doesn't know where
Detective Miller has now appeared, I think, in... Oh, my God, something like 6 of my books. He's in a lot of the Moonlights. He's in Moonlight Weeps, the one that's up for the award.
He wanted to get rid of Moonlight a couple of times, too. He's not nice.
Yeah, he did. But Miller's like...
I like Moonlight.
Yeah, and, you know, you have to be true. You know, this is an Albany novel, and you have to kind of be true to who is doing what in the city. So Miller appears in a lot of the books, you know, a lot of my crime books and hard-boiled books because he's like this guy, he's sort of this lonely cop getting on in years who's, you know, staying on the force because that's his whole life. And, you know, I always picture kind of like a Clint Eastwood character, I guess. But actually, if you really want to know who Miller is, you have to read Moonlight Weeps because that – his story is really brought out in that one.
Yeah.
But he's a no-nonsense cop, but he also has a heart, and he'll also, you know, go the extra mile to get at the truth. And he's really kind of, you know, I've found that over the past few hard-boiled books I've written that he's really become almost like a foundation of those books. It's always a pleasure to, like, bring him in, you know, and to... You know, because I'm writing another Chase Baker novella right now, and he's in that one.
Well, you have to tell
us
about that series after, because I don't know that one. Because when I asked for it, well, they asked me to read it. It only came in an ebook, and I can't read anything on my computer. My eyes really suck. The Chase Baker book.
Oh, the Chase Baker books. Yeah, that's the one series that I put out on my own, under my own label.
Yeah.
But no, they're all, the two big books are in paper, and...
Oh, yeah, I asked for those, and I don't know why Partners in Crime, even when I asked for Everything Burns, that's why I emailed you, because
they only had
e-books.
Probably because when I hired Partners in Crime, the only way they were going to, you know, the review copies were going to be strictly digital. But I'll send you a couple of paper copies.
Yeah, good, because I know that when they send me, they know. Don't ask Fran unless it's a paper copy. And
actually,
yeah,
they know
that, and they like when I do that. They like when I review that. As a matter of fact, what I got was, could you help us out because Steve Martini's whatever needed somebody. So I wound up reading four of his books right away, and I just posted Enemy Inside yesterday. Yeah. And I was like,
okay,
can you help us? I go, why would I do that for you? You're getting paid. I'm not.
Well, you know, it's funny
paid,
because
and I'm not. What can I do?
In this crazy digital world, actually, I'm going through like full circle here, and my next, I have two big books coming out soon.
Oh.
Well, relatively soon, but one of them, Orchard Grove, which comes out in April 16th, is coming out first in hardcover. So
oh, nice.
I haven't actually had a hardcover in many years. It's always been trade paperback and digital. So I'm kind of excited about that. Polis is publishing it. So and then the other book, big book, is Aziz, which I'm pretty sure is coming out from Thomas and Mercer. But it's funny, you know, in this digital heavy world, like going back to hardcover again and all that, which I'm pretty excited about.
I love hardcover and I love large print, people.
Yeah.
I just got David Baldacci's book, The Memory Man. And it's going to, not that it's good, but it's just that the print is really small. So, you know, 18 font, people. Don't go for that 12 and 14. When I get a book, this is how I decide what to review for, seriously. It was a choice between Constant Fear by Daniel Palmer, which is phenomenal, Memory Man, which I started, which is really good, or this little marketing book by Rick Austin, and I picked his book because the print was larger. I mean, whichever.
Well, you know, if you get an e-reader, Fran, you know, you can change the fonts on it.
Yeah, I get my eyes start to bug out because of the glare. I get, like, eye strain.
Oh, does it? You need a paperwhite, a Kindle paperwhite.
Yeah, but besides the fact that I have to, you know, circle and cross out. And by the time I read the book, no one else could really read it because I've underlined it, written there, okay, take from this page, I'm going to remember this page. But I remember it anyway, I forget nothing. And then my husband will look at me, you didn't even take the book inside to write the review. Well, what do you think? Who do you think read it? I forget nothing.
Right.
He hates that.
I do that, you know, so, I still read that way. I still read with a pencil in hand when I'm reading paper and make notes. You know, I still do that.
Well, that's how come my reviews are whatever they are. What could I tell you?
Yeah, no, you write beautiful reviews.
I try. How did you create a world for this character that seems fine 1 minute and he's nuts the next minute?
Well, like I said, I kind of based it on real life, you know. you know, I mean, that's about as far as I could set, you know, as far as I can go with that one, but that's life in some sense, you know. It's obviously life on steroids with this guy, but, you know, I guess at some point you could just say, like, just run away, you know, forget this whole thing and go. And at one point he even thinks that, you know, when his wife goes in for her surgery and he drives, suspecting that she's still talking to David and that it's even more than just talking, he drives to the place where she's having the surgery, and he sees David's truck there, and you know, he even tells himself, that's it. You know, he goes and buys a lighter and starts flicking the lighter, and he's like, I'm out of here. I can't do this. I'm going to go. That this is getting too crazy. But he doesn't. He hangs in there, and things only get worse.
But is he permanently hanging in there? We don't know.
You don't know.
So, you don't know because I don't want to ask too many.
And you don't know in this book, just like Weeps, you don't know in this book until the very last page.
I know. I read the last page over again, and I'm saying, okay, you're bringing him back, aren't you? There's more to say about this guy. You're not done with him yet, right? I hope not, because he's supposedly writing something, and then the last page you find out the truth about something. And I imagine there's got to be some kind of repercussions about it. So let's go back to my other favorite guy, Nick Moonlight. What's next for this for Dick Moonlight? And are you bringing back my other favorite character, the Elvis impersonator? That's hilarious.
know. Everybody
hilarious.
Keeps asking me about the Elvis impersonator.
Yeah, I know. My
I guess I'll have to bring him back at
lot.
Some point.
Yeah,
I know.
Should.
Everybody asks me two things. Are you going to bring back the Elvis impersonator for Moonlight, and are you going to write a sequel to The Remains? Those are the two questions I get the most. And I've already committed to writing a sequel to The Remains, but as far as the Elvis character, I think I'm just going to have to do it, but not the next book. It'll be like two books down the road. Because Moonlight's next case is he's investigating a Chinese human trafficking thing that's going on up in Albany, which is based actually when I was in Italy this past fall, a family of four or five, I believe, were killed execution style by a Chinese gang, like right up the road. I mean, literally little kids made to kneel down while they shot them in the back of the head. And it all has to do with the Chinese restaurants. A lot of the Chinese restaurants, you know, are directly connected to the Chinese mob. So that's going to be his next case. But I haven't started it yet. So I got so many going on at once.
This is exciting. This is really interesting, too, because it's nice to see that there are other people besides ISIS and Islam and all the rest of that doing rotten things. People need to know that they're not the only ones. That's what's scary.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's danger all over the place, yeah.
Now, what about Lola? Is she coming back?
Oh, God. Fran, you're asking me all these questions. I don't know the answer to them yet.
I don't know.
I don't know. I think she's got to come back, right? Maybe?
Yeah.
She has to. She's integral. I mean, you know, she's like, I mean, it ends with, you know, like, it ends as it ends, and Moonlight weeps. So I'll say yes, but I'm not sure in what capacity yet, because first of all, she has to heal, and second of all,
that's in the member certain, yeah.
Right, and that's not really giving too much away, but second of all, is she, you know, is she willing to forgive him again, you know, and all those things. So there's that saga, that ongoing saga, and I think it's that's like the foundation of the story. So of course she has to, you know, he's never going to fall out of love with her. You know, he's always going to be pining for her. So in one way or another, so I think, you know, she has to come back.
Well, I would hope so after the ending. Well, if everybody has to read Moonlight Weeps, people, then you'll get it on the last page. And if you don't, then you really have a problem with your comprehension skills.
Okay. No,
and since I'm
that.
A reading
yeah.
specialist, maybe you should contact me and I'll explain it to you. What can I say?
Yeah, Moonlight's a special guy. Yep.
Yeah, Moonlight is wacky, but he's just funny to deal with. He's just hilarious.
He gets himself into such messes, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
When you start one of those books, it's going to be, you know, it's just going to be a train wreck from, you know, page one to page 300. It's just going to be like, you know, a speeding train wreck.
I know, and I could tell because you just like you're starting to get frustrated because the poor guy can't leave where he starts. And he's trying to get out of wherever he is, and he can't find his way out. Like, somebody calls him to do something else. He's got sort of like this good heart, and that's so sad, I think.
And even with that little piece of bullet in his head,
yeah.
You know, when I first started writing him, I thought like, well, you know, this is physiological. You know, he's got a real problem, and when things get stressful, he tends to screw up because, you know, of what's happening, literally happening in his brain. And now, like, kind of like the Tin Man or whatever, I'm not so sure if that really is the deal. Maybe it's just his personality. You know what I mean? Maybe it's just the way he is. And I think, as the author, I wrestle with that. So, you know, the reader can judge, I guess.
Well, when you bring Reese back, are you going to bring Lisa back and Anna back too?
Oh, I don't think Lisa. I don't know if Reese is coming back.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Need her.
I don't know if I could bring him back.
No.
You know, these are like, you know, Thomas and Mercer wants me to write standalones. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I wasn't gonna write even a sequel to The Remains, but that book has done so well. And so many people have said, I'd like to see. You ever? You might not have read that one, but
no, I didn't.
But
I
so many people want to see what happens after to her life or whatever. So that one, I think, deserves a sequel. I'm not so sure this one is designed for that. But you never know. You just never know. I mean, next year I could be thinking something entirely different.
I'd be curious to see what happens after what he says at the end of the book happens. And
yeah, true. You bring up a good point. So, you know, maybe if I get enough letters on it, then I might. You know, you never know. I'll just leave it that
Otherwise,
way. You never know.
Yeah. Well, Moonlight is a constant. You're not getting rid of Moonlight.
No, Moonlight is just a constant. Well, you know, after I finish every Moonlight, sometimes I'm like, that's it, last one. You know, but then, you know, like you, I mean, people are like, when's the next one coming out? And to be honest, I owe Down and Out like two more of them. So I have to write two more, you know. And, I'll write the guy so long as people keep reading him and so long as he's still alive, you know.
Well, you know, I know if don't do what someone else does to me and kill off the main character or kill off a good character, because every time I read a certain author, I go like, okay, if he kills this person off, I'm going to really be upset. If he kills this one off, and then he killed off a main character, and I go like, that's not fair.
It's kind of like
page.
Right. I mean, like I'm a fan too of authors. I'm a big Charlie Houston fan. And his Hank Thompson series, he just has three of them. And, you know, like, how many times can I keep rereading the same three books of his? And, I think I've even sent him emails. I've never gotten anything in return. But, you know, like, write more Hank Thompson books because they're great. You know, those books are just awesome. And they're they very much influence the Moonlight books, you know. And I'd love to see more of those. But, you know, authors do what authors do. But I'll keep writing Moonlight because, you know, that's probably what's going to put my daughter through college. And I love writing him. You know, he's so much like, I'm able to, like, it's kind of like therapy for me writing a Moonlight book.
Well, it's good, and because he's so unpredictable that you can write just about anything for him, and anything sort of goes with him. But before I forget, I forget nothing. My husband hates it. I forget. I remember everything. Bothers him. I could tell you what he ate the first time we went out 18 years ago. It's horrible. I could even tell you what he wore. And he had a hamburger with French fries, and he wore beige pants and a white shirt, and they all thought he was a doctor, but he's a computer expert. Systems analyst. And he looks at me and he goes, I said, I even remember, I'm very short, I'm 5 feet, and he's like 6'4".
Right.
And we were in ShopRite, a Stop and Shop.
Yeah.
And he said, this girl comes over, and she was tall, and she just got me annoyed. And she looks at me and she says, can I borrow him to get the snack? Well, I said, I think maybe you could reach it. I said, if I stand on my toes, I'll get it for you. I was like, excuse me? I didn't know what to
laugh. Excuse me, that's my man.
Yeah, I did. I looked at her. I said to her, I may be little, and I did play basketball as a kid. I said, so, you know, don't worry. You don't want me to block you with my wide end. And at that point,
you
I
can
had
be
a wide
like...
end. Yeah, I mean, don't even go there. I mean, and then we walked into the Gap, and this girl comes over to him. He says, can he try on this sweater for me? Because it's like my boyfriend's. I said, the sales guy's the same size. And my husband looked at me. He says,
don't mess
you.
With Fran.
Yeah.
Don't mess with Fran.
That's exactly, and yet, when I went to buy my husband.
Well, you're a New Yorker, man. You know, you're right down from
Bronx
the city.
Bronx girl, you don't mess with Bronx girls. Let me tell you.
You don't mess with a
Bronx
girl. That's right.
That's what they told me. I better not forget this either. Next Thursday, I only do the shows at 10 o'clock in the morning, except when the author lives in California. So be ready, people, for The Fall by John Leskla. I'm like
nice.
So, and then the week after, okay, so I don't do shows on Tuesdays, but this time I'm doing one, Joseph Finder, The Fixer. What would you
Joe
do if you found...
Yeah,
do you believe? Right. I like, oh, my God, they emailed me and said, would you do The Fixer? I go, that was another one of those books that gave me eye strain. I read it in less than 2 hours.
Looking forward to reading that one. Joe's a good guy.
Oh, what would you do if you found $3.4 million in your father's house in a back wall. That's all I'm going to say.
I know. How enticing is that?
Yeah, very
enticing. That sounds like
not only is
it sounds like a real winner.
But what this guy does with it and how he manages to deal with this much money is hilarious. I mean, it's like amazing. Yeah. And what he goes through.
I'm really looking
forward to reading
that.
The other book
that
I just finished, it's not yet. I get all these not out yet books. Constant Fear. What happens when a group
that one I'm looking forward to, too.
Yeah, it's a group of students that decided to hack into rich people's bank accounts and take some of their money and give it to charities and to the poor. But when they hack into the website, the bank account of a Mexican cartel, you have no idea what they go through. It is really scary. If this doesn't teach kids and adults not to hack, this book should do it. And Daniel Palmer, his father wrote great medical thrillers, and I interviewed Michael twice before he died. And Daniel's endings are the best. Oh, my God, scary. Really scary.
Oh, awesome.
And
yeah,
I just finished Radiant Angel by Nelson DeMille. What would you do if somebody decided to replay and reenact 9/11? That's all I'm going to say.
Wow.
I get to read. Yeah, they send it to me and I go like, oh my goodness, this appeared in my mailbox. And I'm really excited because I just got an email from John Grisham's publicist in October. They're going to send me The Rogue to review.
Wow.
I'm going like, yeah, but
you're
still
busy,
have
Fran.
Too busy.
What are you doing talking to me? You got all these big time writers.
I love crime writers. I love crime writers. It's my favorite thing. Maybe someday I'll actually write one that makes sense. And yeah. And my new magazine, MJ6, is coming out, I hope in June or July.
Nice.
And I would love you or anyone that wants to write articles on writing tips, why you choose a specific way to write in the beginning of your story.
Sure.
Watch your opinion section. My watch your opinion section, I haven't decided on my topics yet. Usually are some kind of controversial thing that's in the news. I wrote one on voicemails. Are there ever really people out there when you answer the phone? What happens when doctors don't apologize for being 3 hours late and keep the patients waiting? What's your opinion? When was daylight savings time? Do we really need it? Not really.
No.
So I have a few more questions. Okay. What type of novel have you not written? Would you like to try? Great American novel.
The Great American Novel that speaks to everybody. You know. I mean, I started. I think every novel. You know, when I first started, in the business, if you want to call it that, this is a crazy circus. It's not a business. I wanted to write the Great American Novel, I guess, but I'm not saying I haven't done that in a way, but, I think a lot of my books stand up to literature, but some literature anyway, but someday I might, sit down and just write, my version of The Stranger A Farewell to Arms or whatever. You know what I mean? Like the Great American Novel. Who knows?
That would be cool. Would you ever write like Steve Barry? I mean, he's unreal. The Patriot Threat was probably one of the best books I've read in a long time. I learned a lot about the 16th Amendment and whether we should be paying taxes and a whole bunch of stuff from that one. Would you ever write historical fiction?
Yeah, for sure. I'm loosely, the Chase Baker I'm writing now is loosely historical in nature, in that it deals with this woman, Clara Harris, who she and her husband, Henry Rathbone, were the two people inside Abraham Lincoln's presidential box at Ford's Theater when he was shot.
Oh, nice.
The two guests were supposed to be Grant and his wife, but Grant was literally out boozing himself to death already. So Mary Todd Lincoln invited these two people, and these two people were actually from Albany, New York. And when Lincoln was shot, Henry Rathbone actually attacked John Wilkes Booth, and Wilkes Booth had a knife in the other hand. He had a gun in one hand and a knife in the other, and he sliced Henry Rathbone's arm up, and
ooh,
all his blood got on Clara's dress, and some of Lincoln's blood got on Clara's white dress as well. And that dress was hidden inside a house in Albany forever. And my first wife grew up in that house. And they, and the house was supposed to be haunted and all this sort of stuff.
Ooh,
anyway,
gosh.
You know, I use the whole thing in a fictional way, of course, but there's a lot of historical truth to it. So I'm just playing with it. So, you know, this is more like an alternative history, I think. Is that what they would call that now? Maybe alternative history? I'm not sure. But but for sure, I would mess with historical fiction. And I'd also like to write a nonfiction book, you know, one of these days as well. I've toyed with proposals in the past, and in my early days, I even wrote some proposals for other authors. But I've never actually really, you know, even as a journalist, sat down and written, you know, some big nonfiction piece. But it's something I'd definitely like to do one day.
Well, that's why I wrote the piece about my mother. That's considered nonfiction, they said.
Absolutely, yeah, and it's a wonderful book.
Yeah, I wrote it, and you know, it's funny because I'm so glad that you read it, and Carla read it, and a whole bunch of other people read it,
yeah.
And it's funny because my family has not read it.
I handed it to my mother,
they can't read it.
Yeah.
You gave it
to
your mother.
Yeah, well, I handed it to my mother. She's like, I don't know if I want to read this.
Yeah.
You know?
A lot of people did.
It's scary.
As a matter of fact, I won't say which New York Times bestselling author started to read it and said that he couldn't deal with the topic.
Right. Yeah, it's a hard topic to deal with. It must have been a difficult topic to write.
It was, not only was it hard to write it, it was hard to live it for 12 years.
Sure.
And watching her, my mother was a force to be reckoned with. And when Ruthie, my mother never yelled, never raised her voice, and never hit, ever.
Right.
She just stared at you with those eyes, and you knew.
And you knew she meant business.
You knew just yes, Ma. And I found after a while, it was like, okay, I'm not going to get, I don't need my. And if you didn't do what she said, it was a 45-minute lecture standing talking to my father, explaining why he didn't want my mother aggravated, because it would only aggravate him. And which was really worse. And then my grandmother, but my grandmother was my champion. My grandmother, and I mean, true story, my mother, when I was 5, my kindergarten teacher was absent, and I didn't like the substitute who was assistant principal, and my mother came and walked me to school, but she was wearing her pajamas under her pants, under her shirt, so she never got dressed, swear to God. I thought she was going to kill me when she got home because I wouldn't let her come out of the classroom, and it was hot.
Right.
And the principal said to her, why don't you, you know, pick off your jacket? And my mother gave me a look. She was going to, for the first time at 5 years old, she was going to really let me have it. And my grandmother said, if you dare, she's not your child anymore. That's it. You get away from
her.
That's it. My grandmother protected me from my mother. She said, it was your fault. You should not have gone to school with your, you know, like that. You should have just gotten dressed, and it's your own fault that you did that. And if she's afraid of the assistant principal, then the teacher literally had to call my mother when she was going to be absent.
Right. Well, I think I'm still going through trauma from when I would miss the school bus and my mother would have to drive me to school in her her nightgown with like a trench coat put over it or whatever, you know, and be like, "Oh my God." That was like a kind of punishment or something for missing the bus.
Well, that was it. She went with her nightgown whatever, and my mother was the PTA president. And he didn't mess with Ruthie. And, my God, I mean, she was a trip and a half. So writing this story about her, there was a day in 2002 where she said to me, I can't remember things like I used to. And I know I'm a bookkeeper, but I can't. And it just, she knew.
So she was noticing
She noticed it, and then we went and had her tested, and they realized the year after that she had a mini stroke, but nobody picked it up. And then she had surgery in 2003, and they lost her twice, and they said from the overdose of anesthesia, it caused her to start to have the memory loss. And she said to my sister and myself, don't ever put me in a nursing home. I'd rather have home health aides. And unless you are there and know what to look for, you could get some screwy people. And I went through about 8 or 9 agencies until I came with Partners in Care, which was, you know, started out rocky, but I turned out 6 people that literally I couldn't do what they did to save my mother. So, writing the nonfiction piece about her was hard, but you know what? I feel that maybe out there some people will learn something, and it'll show people that, you know, you
have to understand.
She said the most horrible things sometimes. I mean, I walked in one day and she said to me, "You look like a slut." I said, "Ma, you finally got my profession right. What can I tell you?" And my sister turned around and I looked at her and my sister said, "Well, I've always been the one that's prim and proper." And I miss my sister. When she died, forget it. I lost my partner in crime and my best friend. My sister and I would walk down the street and act like Laverne and Shirley, two stupid kids acting, you know, dancing and carrying on. And
I'm sure you miss her.
There's nobody to be silly with anymore. You know, you got to have a silliness. But anyway, so where can people learn more about you and your website?
Always go to www.vincentzandri.com. And it has all my Facebook, Twitter, all that garbage on it. And I keep all the news is up to date. Let's see, I'm doing a reading in New York, I think at NYU, on June 24th. And then I'll be at ITW, International Throw Arise, obviously. I'll be signing books there on Friday at 5 o'clock, the first Friday of the event. And like I said, the books coming out are Aziz, that's another standalone, and Orchard Grove from Polis will be out in April. I have a new Chase Baker coming out, and I have also a Chase Baker novella, and I'll be starting on another Moonlight very quickly. I'm also kind of happy, I probably shouldn't say it, but there's already some movie interest in Orchard Grove, which I'm pretty Orchard Grove, but Aziz, even as I talk now, there's a production company in New York that's giving it a good look.
That is great. And I am looking forward to the Thriller Fest. I will be there July 10th and 11th and 12th.
Can't wait
on the
to
Friday,
see you.
Saturday, and Sunday. And I'm getting a press pass, too. Ha-ha. Not bad.
You know, you're getting a press pass. That's what I should do, get a press pass instead of having to pay the fee.
Well, that's a great idea. I was honored because John Land invited me. I don't know what happened to Larry Thompson. I've been trying to email him because he invited us last year, and I didn't have to pay the fee. It was great. But with a press pass, I'm going to do a story for MJ Magazine when I get there. Yeah, and I'm going to do a whole big thing article for my review site, Just Reviews, which is me. And I'm not Kirkus, but I'm Just Reviews, and you don't have to pay me to get 1,500 words. I went and I counted the words in their reviews the other day. They're not even 300 words. And the people are paying $500 for that. And they're good reviews. It's just that mine are free. And they are good. So I want to thank you so much. And,
all right. Thank you, Fran.
And
always great to talk to you. I know we always go off on these great tangents. I love it.
We don't want to tell everybody all about this book because this was really one of my favorites, and I'm putting it back on the shelf because nobody's getting it. Because
When you come to ITW, you can pick up a few others. I'll just slip them off to you, and you can hand those to your.
Are people bringing books this time?
I think there'll be a ton of my books at the bookstore.
Okay,
certainly a bunch of Moonlights, Everything Burns, The Remains. It will definitely be at the bookstore, I'm sure.
Yeah, I know. They wanted me, last time I meant to get, I have to convince him to give me one, R.L. Stine. He's going to give me something because my nephew reads him. And he sent
my
him an autograph
him, so,
or whatever, but I haven't read him. I haven't read Linwood Barclay, and there are a few people there.
Linwood's good. I like he's I think I don't know how many books he's got or not, but I like his stuff a lot.
Someone's gonna have to introduce me to him because I didn't meet him. Steve Martini, I read everything he wrote. The last Paul Medriani book that I just finished, Enemy Inside, was probably the best. That was really
okay. Well,
really,
I think all those
really
guys
good.
Will be there. Yeah.
I'm going to be just in awe standing in the same room with you guys, with you and Nelson DeMille. I'm going like, oh my god. Oh my
Joe
god.
Joe Finder
Nelson
will be
DeMille.
There. Joe's always there.
I know. He, as a matter of fact, Joe knew it
Lee
was
Lee Child
last
will
time.
Be there. He's always there.
I don't think I read him. But Steve Berry walked out last time and said, I know that voice and I know you. And everybody around looked at me in awe like, oh, my God, he knows you. I go, I hope so.
All right. Well, you're going to be the intrepid literary reporter, right? Janie on the spot. So
that's exactly,
you know, I can't wait to
I'm
see it.
Come with my little pad and pen and take
all
notes, right? And write some really wonderful things about everybody. I never write anything bad. It would be bad.
All
so
right.
Thank
I hope
you so,
so
much.
I hope so. Thank you, Fran.
You're
thanks
welcome.
For having me, and I look forward to seeing
you're
and
welcome.
Talking to you again. Thanks again.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.